Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Seems like just yesterday we were at it again.
And what's interesting is that the number of things to discuss in an average week is just unbelievable. I mean, the list just grows and grows, and there's so much going on, so much happening. We have so little time for some of the other news that we should be getting to because there's so much that's affecting Israel and the Jewish world.
And so many things, not only of immediacy, but of long-term consequences. And it's what I try to tell people, that at times I know you feel overwhelmed, and we talk about issues that are sometimes disturbing, certainly not always pleasant to hear, but if you understand the importance of each of these things in for our children, our grandchildren, their children, and the immediacy of this moment in history, I don't remember when we had in many years so many complex challenges coming at one time. And we try to simplify them and not just give the rhetoric about it, but to understand the dynamics so you can look ahead to what the direction. And believe me, the best experts in the world don't know right now where these things are going to lead.
Right. I just wish that some of the responsible world leaders would at least understand the immediacy and the importance of what you're describing. Sometimes it seems that they don't. In fact, it's funny because I got that impression. I mentioned last week the Time magazine cover story on Bibi. I got that impression from the from those who were responsible for writing that story. I think there were three different people on it. That he gets it, that he understands, at least, again, whether you agree with his policies or not, or where he's going direction-wise, but he does understand that we are at the crossroads of some very important historical moments.
And they escalate in ways that can't be predicted. The unfortunate and tragic murder of a young IDF soldier on the border with Gaza today, and, of course, Israel will respond to it. Any one of these things can touch off so much broader reaction there and elsewhere, which you can never anticipate. And I think you're right that Bibi does understand and tries to discuss it, and he doesn't want to be seen always as a flamethrower and doesn't want Israel to be the focus of, let's say, a discussion on Iran or a discussion of Syria. Obviously, it has immediate and direct implications, but I think the longer-term consequences, the broader consequences, are often lost, and you don't get the sense of urgency from world leaders that one would hope for.
The Israeli officials today released a statement in analyzing what happened to this Israeli soldier, unfortunately, getting killed in this gunfire battle. They said that it prevented, whatever was done, prevented a much larger terrorist attack. Now, that is based on circumstance of the actual episode this morning, or is it based on intelligence? How do the Israeli officials know that somebody was in for it and that they were looking for something much bigger than this?
Because they noticed the breach in the fence. And the border fence between Israel and the southern part of the Gaza Strip, and this was about 5:30 in the morning, and this is not an unusual circumstance. We've had many attempts and constant attempts to try to breach the security fence that separates Gaza from Israel, and have a shooting incident of this kind. But it's very rare that somebody, actually one of these terrorists, actually has the ability to get across, and there was this exchange of fire, and the Palestinian was stopped right away. And then now there are reports that the IAF, the Israeli Air Force, is hitting certain targets. But we know that there have been plots to try and kidnap Israeli soldiers, and they believe that this may have been part of one of those attempts.
So this is it. I mean, as we said many times around the time of the release of Gilad Shalit, and I'm not equating anything or, again, bringing up whether it should have been done or not, but that's what the enemy wants. The enemy wants live Israeli soldiers at this point, and they're going to keep going after them.
They want to, and this, by the way, may not have been with Hamas's approval. This is clearly, from the indications so far, Islamic Jihad. They took initial responsibility. They later retracted it, and they already have a name. They think he's from Khan Yunis. So it doesn't mean that the all of the groups, that Hamas included, actually endorsed this attack, this particular attempt. In fact, they've been trying to restrain some of it for their own reasons. But the goal of trying to kidnap Israeli soldiers or Israeli civilians to hold them hostage has been a constant one. And thank God the IDF has been effective in preventing it.
Right. And one could argue that it was certainly the same goal even before Gilad Shalit was exchanged.
A consistent goal.
Right. All right. It may sound like a broken record here, but, you know, and again, I'm reading so much about what the media has to say about Bibi and his hand on the trigger, you know, his hand on the button, and God knows what may happen and what he may start with Iran. And then you see this week that there was a very effective attack on Iran, and of course not one bullet was fired, so to speak, and I'm talking about the cyber attacks. This morning we read about how President Obama is continuing the tradition of his predecessor and helping out with these cyber attacks. Israeli officials are certainly winking very hard, if not openly admitting that Israel has a lot to do with it. I mean, this we could be in the middle of the war right now, Malcolm.
We are in a this is a virtual war, i.e., the war in cyberspace. I had reported here that Iran was investing $1 billion in developing their own cyber capacity, both to defend against such attacks, but also to be able to go on the offense. Other countries are similarly investing a great deal of expertise, money, resources in this because this is the new frontier. This is where you can control virtual segments of the of vital infrastructure, and security of a country can be directly impacted. They say that this virus flame evaded detection by 43 different antivirus programs that the Iranians had. And it's huge. Stuxnet was only 1 megabyte. This is 20 megabytes. So it's a huge virus that you would think by its size would be more readily detectable. But it seems that it even disrupted its the oil exports. It shut down some oil terminals, the information flow, many other things, and that it's hidden inside, and it can even eavesdrop on phone calls. It has all sorts of capacities that can compromise the security of a country.
So who needs rockets, guns, and nuclear weapons? we have a successful effort going on right now against Iran.
It is definitely one of the methodologies, but it's not what's going to bring about the change in and of itself. It does weaken a country. It is like it is another sanction against Iran. But when we look at Iran's aggressiveness, it continues. They're still continuing the subterfuge. They're trying to clean up the site. We understand that several buildings now are missing from Parchin. That, you know, by monitoring it by satellite, one can detect such developments, and they clean up the soil. And even with that, of course, the IAEA inspectors found uranium that was enriched to 27%, and whether it was because of a surge and accidental, it means that they can do it. It
right.
proves they can do it. And they can clean up all the sites, the buildings can disappear, but we know. And the head of the army, General Jaftari, went to visit the three islands that are claimed by the United Arab Emirates in a direct confrontation, in a direct declaration. I mean, this is a declaration of war when somebody else claims these lands. They go there, and then they hook them up to their mobile telephone system. So people will say, well, who cares? Why is that significant? The answer is that it's very significant. This means that they're dependent now on the Iranian system for any kind of contact. And most of these islands are not inhabited by two of them are not. One is Ahmadinejad had gone there first. But my the underlying point to me that is so important is that you see the aggressiveness with which Iran is continuing. They're providing arms to Syria. Rosatom of Russia announced they're going to build another reactor at Bushehr.
Yeah, this is all because if you're losing on one front, you have to shore up your other fronts.
Or it says it's a declaration to say, look, no matter how much you think you're weakening us,
right.
no matter how much you're hurting
right.
us, we can still do these things. But these are not insignificant steps. The Emirates stop trading Iranian oil. And we know that the Gulf countries, the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and others, are talking about how Iran is instigating violence locally, and that more and more people are coming to recognize what we've talked about now since this whole turmoil started, that it's really this Sunni-Shiite battle, and it's a battle of control. It's a battle for the future of the entire region. And they can reach out. They make new deals with Venezuela, with Bolivia. They're doing all these things in order to indicate that they have this ability. They retain the ability, but they're certainly being hurt by the sanctions.
Right. I'm laughing because you're going to be heading to your grandson Ephraim's bar mitzvah tomorrow, right? So mazel tov to you. But here's why I'm laughing. Because you know that at some point tomorrow, sometime from when you put on your talus until you finish Kiddush, someone's going to come over to you and say, I don't get it, Malcolm. Can't Israel in cyber fashion just destroy the nuclear capability of Iran? Like, why can't they just take the same? Why can't they take the same worm, the same cyber attack, and dismantle the entire facility?
Well, first of all, thank you for the mazel tov.
We'll get to the formal one later.
I have to say, if that was the comment, it's a lot better than most of them that I get.
I love it. But, you know, I'm telling you that's going to happen. You know, I don't understand. Israel should take an extra 30 to 60 seconds and toss in a virus that will dismantle the entire thing, that'll bring every city where they have a nuclear capability being built completely to its knees.
It's part of the problem is that people look at these things with the simplicity of, let's say, OC Rock.
Right,
they say
right.
All the time. They right. do it once, do it again.
Different world today.
Without understanding how complex this is, and that Iran is a strong power, and they have very smart scientists, they have intelligent people working there, and you saw from the IAEA reports, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and I'm sure people are tired of hearing this, but, I mean, it's our future when you see how since February they have increased their monthly production, that they have more than 350 more centrifuge machines operating, that they have produced over 6 tons of enriched uranium to 3.5, and we don't even know how much to 20%, that despite all of the efforts and all of the Stuxnet and other the elimination of nuclear scientists and other work accidents that have occurred, we see the progress that they've been able to make and how much closer they come all the time, and that they can still pay for Russian and North Korean ships to bring arms to Syria and declare to the world that they're fighting with them.
Amazing. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard and listeners sponsored, WFMU East Orange, MFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. You know, in the context of, especially as we remember our own history, I have to ask you the following question to start the topic of what's going on in Syria. Is the Syrian government actually giving orders to its military to eliminate women and children who have been the majority of the victims this week in the shootings and the murders that are going on in Syria?
That's a very good question. And the answer is that in Syria, nothing happens of the scale. It doesn't mean they gave a specific order to go and kill in the way that they did.
And who they went and killed.
And there are a lot of other questions that will need to be answered, including the reports by people who were there when the massacres took place, that some of the officers giving orders were speaking in Farsi, which is Iranian, and the question of Iran Revolutionary Guard presence, Hezbollah presence, others. These were clearly Alawites. They're from the Fourth Army, which is and from the sect that Assad comes from, and the ones that are, you know, have the most at stake in all of this. But the viciousness with which this was carried out, I think, should be a warning about what we're dealing with, the determination of the regime to preserve itself. And as Assad told me, and I reported here, that after the fighting started, that he told me he would never step down. He said, because I will get out, but my people will be massacred. He knew that the feelings of animosity and the desire for retribution would be very great. So he continues to get arms coming from Lebanon, coming from other borders. We saw the exercises in Jordan the past week where you had 10, 15 countries involved, but we learned that the focus of it was exercises geared to how do you control chemical missiles, missiles laden with chemical weapons because of the huge stockpiles in Syria. And here you had Arab and American troops training for this eventuality. So Syria has still an infrastructure that should be worrisome and troublesome to everybody. The United States has taken this as a serious challenge because of what happened in Libya, but the problem is that the whole world has shown the difference of what they say they can do and what they're willing to do.
But did that change this week at all?
No, if anything, you see that the Secretary of Defense said again today that, or yesterday, that they won't act without U.N. approval. Well, you'll never get U.N. approval because the Russians have said they're not going to ever allow it.
But it felt a little different this week. Did the media report it differently? Did they take it more seriously or plastered? Or
humiliated again by the Iranians who sit and negotiate as they have every time in the past. In 2003, 2004, they reached agreements and immediately violated them. They talked about how they mocked their interlocutors. And here they sat with them in two sessions, and they're now heading for a third in Moscow, and they announced that they're going ahead, that there's no way that they're going to stop enriching to 20%. And whether that is their final position or not, it's the public declarations. It's the humiliation that goes with it, and that also relates to the fact that people, these kind of guys, look at what's going on in Syria, and sees that with all the power that the countries involved, including the Arab League, being against it, they can't effectuate anything.
So it's good
they can't take the kind of determinate steps that are necessary. They expel the diplomat, but. So what? Who cares? Do you think the Syrians are going to act because of it? We criticize the Russians for their arms sales to Syria, and Russia says, okay, criticize us. We don't care. We have a vested interest here. We're going to protect our interests. The fact that people are being massacred in this way, you know, they did criticize it, but it's pro forma.
Yeah, so, but what are you calling for then? You're calling for increased sanctions, or you're calling for the ouster of Assad by world powers?
You know, the removal of Assad, the Israelis and others in the region, Arabs, I believe, is inevitable. And it may be, but it could be a year before its inevitability kicks in. And the question is, what will replace it? If you look at what's happening with the opposition, it is very divided. And you have the clan differences, the tribal differences come into play, the religious differences, et cetera, amongst the opposition. And you have two. You have the opposition inside, which seems to be becoming more professional, and the forces there are fighting. And then you have the opposition outside, which is just a farce. The Muslim Brotherhood playing more of a role, especially with the outside forces and controlling the funds. But if there were a leadership that one could see now, in the Syrian army, the Free Syrian Army, or in the National Council, but one doesn't see any emerging leadership that could guide the country that will be able to take over. And the last thing you want is a complete collapse. It could threaten Israel. It will certainly spill over into Lebanon. We've already seen that in the past week, some of the steps that are the explosions that took place and the confrontations between the pro and anti-Assad forces. And they say it could lead to terrorism with Israel.
It's the same type of situation we've seen in Egypt.
Well, it's like Libya after Gaddafi.
Yeah, and
there,
Libya.
They were able to contain him. We saw the heavy investment there, and nobody knows what the final outcome will be. In Egypt, it's exactly right. But there, the difference is that you had a national army that could step in.
Yeah, but
a national identity also.
But you also have said that the Iranians could enforce their own power in Egypt, just like I'm sure they would in Syria, right?
No, they can't in Egypt.
Even with the Muslim Brotherhood?
They can influence and they can try to direct, but the anti-Iranian feeling amongst Egyptians and others in the Arab world is very great.
All right, but the Syrian-Iranian alliance, that's a given.
That's a given. That's different. That's right. Iran has a much greater investment there. They know that this would affect their ability to continue control Lebanon and to have access.
All right. So when you demand that the Russians stop selling to Syria and they play a more active role with sanctions and they crack down, this is essentially from a human rights angle. This is because you just said that whether Assad's ouster is inevitable or not. It's going to take a while. So this is so the plea to Russia, the plea to the United Nations, or the plea to European countries, or those that have stepped up this week, it seemed, and spoken a little bit about a bit more about the Syrian situation, is strictly a human rights issue?
It's not strictly. I mean, obviously people can't look at those pictures of dead children and I think be indifferent, but but there's a much broader issue, and that is the stability of the region. Syria is a critical country. This is not Tunisia or Libya, even though they are very important, and we're seeing the aftermath where Tunisian soldiers are appearing in places that never were before, and the instability continues, and we don't know what the final outcome in any of these countries will be, as we saw in Egypt, which we can talk about, we have to talk about. But the point is with Syria is that we have to try and forge, and efforts by the West to try and bring the opposition together have failed, because Syria is not a real country. Syria is made up of, was cobbled together by the colonialists. It's made up of different parties, like Libya, which is 147, and that's the distinction from Egypt, which does have a national identity and has a national army that could step in and fill the void, even if people today are angry at it or whatever. People recognize the role of the army. They respected it. They enabled them to fill the void. You have nothing comparable. So when people say just to remove Assad, you got to ask the second question, what's going to follow? Are we going to have chaos, which will be disastrous for Jordan, which is anyway in a delicate position, for Lebanon, for Israel, for Turkey, for everybody?
So Russia may be saying, I'd rather have an unstable Syria with Assad than an unstable Syria without him.
Russia is playing its interests, and they could easily come into more greater compliance with the other countries, work on resolutions. We know, and part of the reason why Syria continues to do what it does is because they know they have the guarantee that Russia will veto, let's say, a Security Council resolution to try and put troops in there to contain the situation.
All right. So as much as a guy like me thinks there's been progress against Syria this week, and it seemed to me that the media was heading in that direction, it's really not true.
There is public opinion, world public opinion. There's the revulsion of the world, the condemnation, even by...
More awareness, right.
But even the condemnation by Russia about it.
Right.
Greater awareness that of the seriousness and of the brutality. But what does it mean next week in terms of steps to actually stop it? You see that every time the Arab League can pass resolution and resolution, they can't do anything. The West has Security Council resolutions. We can't stop the ships coming there with weapons.
Right. We've spoken about the popularity or the vast support right now that the Israeli government is enjoying, all the seats that are in the coalition, et cetera, et cetera. Then Ehud Barak comes out with an idea about a unilateral declaration of the two-state solution, essentially that Israel should unilaterally decide what the borders are of the two states and proceed from there. Now, I would guess that on both sides of this issue, meaning the majority of Israelis and the majority of those, let's call them under the PA, would be very much not in favor of this idea. Wasn't this a very bad time? Wasn't it bad timing for Barak to toss this idea out there?
Well, it was immediately rejected by the Palestinians, but it also coincided with the declaration by Netanyahu calling on the Palestinians to come to the table and saying that it was time for them to sit down and talk. So maybe, I mean, it could be that this was deliberate to put the pressure on the Palestinians to say, okay, if you guys are not going to talk, we're going to get all the international pressure and be made the bad guys because there are no negotiations, and people will accuse us if there's a spillover effect and, you know, we don't contribute to this. So we're going to say we're prepared to go so far that we'll make unilateral concessions. A, I don't think that it's something that could be implemented, and B, I think it forced them to come out right away and say, we reject the idea, this is not the way to get the negotiation, get the peace, to have a unilateral move by Israel of this kind.
So it may have simply been a strategy. Do you agree the majority of Jews in Israel would not have gone for this?
I believe the majority of Jews would not. I believe the majority of the Knesset would probably not, and I don't know even if Barak would in the end.
Do you agree that the term Polish death camp is not as insensitive a term as some have accused President Obama of this week?
Well, those who have been to Poland and have visited, whether it's Auschwitz or any of the other camps, know that the Poles and the Polish government and certainly the people are very sensitive about this issue. They always refer to them as German camps and German concentration camps, and to a greater degree deny the role of Polish citizens in the operations of the camps and making possible a lot of what took place and in some places contributing greatly to it. So I think that the politically correctness dictated that the president correct what he said, and perhaps if he had said the concentration camps in Poland, but ascribing them to Poland and said the Polish people, the Polish government, as opposed to the German government, is what's very sensitive.
And in all fairness, the Polish government never set up death camps. I think it was a point that was attributed to Shin Bet, a rise in terror plots versus Israel and Jews. Now, again, those of us who follow the news don't feel this. You always tell us how many of these attacks are quelled, and obviously we went into detail this morning about the one that unfortunately caused the falling of an Israeli soldier at the hand of the enemy this morning. Is this all a result of Egypt because of the instability now on that border? Is it is the enemy becoming more creative and trying more and more than ever to infiltrate with terror attacks?
Well, there's several answers to that. One is it's not the origin of it because it existed when Mubarak was in power, but Mubarak did work with Israel to try and contain it, but it was limited there to Gaza. You did not have it in the Sinai, which the Egyptian army was more effective in controlling, and you've had the complete breakdown since the fall of the government of law and order there, and you had thousands of prisoners who escaped the prisons and went to Sinai, and you've had the investment by Iran, Al-Qaeda, many other terrorist groups operating there, making it a quasi-Somalia, and the Egyptians told me that they lost control of it immediately after revolution in Egypt. So, yes, to a degree, the fall of Mubarak contributed greatly to the fact that you have even Al-Qaeda along Israel's border, the activities that are going on there, whether it's drugs and all sorts of other criminal activity, but also the smuggling of weapons into the Sinai, both to go to Gaza and to stay there, and the linkages between various factions between Gaza and the Sinai.
When do we get the final days of the Egyptian election?
So that's a good question. It's coming in mid-June. It's going to be the next round. This is a runoff between the two candidates.
Will this be the final round?
Yes, this will be the final round. But, perhaps. Officially, yes, it's the final round. But when you see the reaction of people to the fact that you have these two candidates, and 40 to 45% of the Egyptian people were essentially rejecting both the former Mubarak regime candidate and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, last in the parliamentary elections, got 47% of the vote. They got 25% now, and all the Islamist parties got 44% as opposed to 75% in the parliamentary election. So I think a lot of people are having second thoughts in Egypt about what it would mean for a Muslim Brotherhood.
So there's more than one country on this globe that has trouble coming up with a couple of good candidates? But as I mentioned that, of course, Mitt Romney has just wrapped up the nomination, you know.
But, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood made a mistake because as soon as they won control of the parliament, they started to show their true colors. This week they called for Mussari, the presidential candidate from the Muslim Brotherhood, said that Christians have to pay fizya, which is a tax, a financial tribute of non-Muslims, or to leave. And we've heard many other things about the rights of women and et cetera that they have threatened already in this election. So now you have a former prime minister under Mubarak and a Muslim Brotherhood candidate. You had the burning down of the headquarters of the Mubarak candidate and people rejecting it. You remember there were 13 candidates. We're now down to the runoff of two. How they fooled the public opinion pollsters about guys like Amri Musa, who had always been seen as front runner and number two, and other people, Hutu, who was then surging ahead, and none of these guys made the cut, got single-digit votes. Less than half the people actually voted in the Egyptian election. So obviously, I think that you could have a tremendous unrest after this round of the election, because you're going to have many, many dissatisfied people and saying this is not what we carried out the revolution to have a former Mubarak.
But that's not what usually calls for new elections. People being dissatisfied is not usually what calls for new elections.
No, but I said the period of unrest. I didn't say another round of elections necessarily, right. And the Constitution doesn't call for it. But what it could do is strengthen the hand of the army, because people will say we want stability. The army gives continuity, and they are obviously trying to protect, first and foremost, their economic interests, because they control about 30% of the economy. And they of course, want to sustain power. In order to do that, the Muslim Brotherhood and others have been working consistently to try and take away the power from the army, as they did in Turkey and other places, because the army is usually a force for stability and even pro-Western orientation.
So the likelihood is that the next leader of Egypt will not have a summit with the Prime Minister of Israel, most likely.
I would say that was a fairly safe bet. I think if the Muslim Brotherhood candidate wins, which means they control both elements of the government, and remember the Salafists were working against the Muslim Brotherhood candidate because they don't want to see the Muslim Brotherhood controlling everything and feel that they will be cut out as well. So you have really a very complex situation, and as I said before, you can't predict what will be in Egypt.
You ignored my comment about Romney wrapping up the Republican nomination.
I didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
What I said.
Romney did wrap up the nomination, and now we're going to enter another phase and perhaps get a lull in the summer.
So there's two men left. There's two men left in this race. That would be Obama and Romney. That was the comparison, trying to find a couple of good candidates out there. And
I think it'll be
the president
will be very important in this election, from all that I can see.
What will be important? I'm sorry.
The debates. I think a lot of people are waiting, and there are only a few states that they say are really in play. But I think it'll be more.
By the way, I've been echoing your words about how seriously people should take the congressional races this year.
That's exactly right. You see how many races are really, really close, and how important what happens in Congress is. We saw it this week with the legislation about Palestinian refugees. Mark Kirk, who unfortunately had a stroke, the great senator from Illinois, moving to try and force UNRWA to tell the truth about the number of refugees. I mean, I think they serve as 5 million or 10 million. 10 million is certainly claimed already by the Palestinians, but they serve as millions of people. And they're saying, why don't you want to give money to poor people? Then say you're giving it to poor people. Don't say they're refugees. What is the fifth generation still a refugee? Is everybody who moved in from outside into the camps defined as a refugee? This is a very interesting piece of legislation and complements, I think, previous legislation that dictates that when they talk about a refugee problem, American officials, that is, they have to mention both refugee issues, the Jewish refugees and the Palestinians. But when we talk about the Palestinians, UNRWA has become a self-sustaining growth industry, and we know that many of their schools still continue to incite. We know about the corruption and the countless billions, hundreds of billions probably, that have been spent on UNRWA over the years. And they've done nothing either to resettle or to solve the plight of the people, but rather perpetuate the problem and in fact, inflame it.
Unbelievable.
I want to mention one other thing that there was on the Internet. You know, we often talk about why people shouldn't always believe what they read or what they see. It was on the Internet charges against the University of Texas that they had joined the boycott of Israel or of academics, and it's exactly the reverse. University of Texas did the right thing, so I want people not to write them. They were getting blasted. What happened was there was a book being published with 29 articles about, I think, women in the Middle East, and two were by Israelis. The Arabs then said that they don't want their things in their articles in it. If the Israelis, they demanded two Israeli authors, the contributions be removed. And the University of Texas said, you don't want them? We're not going to publish it at all.
Yeah.
And people, the headline, unfortunately, misrepresented it, and people started jumping on them. And in fact, people should write them and say they did the right thing when they stood up against those who seek to perpetuate the boycott, especially in academic settings.
All right, go Longhorns. That's the Longhorns University of Texas, right? I think so.
The state is.
I hope I got it right. Your reaction to non-Orthodox clergy being put on the payroll of the State of Israel?
I'm not sure of what it really means. And I mean, it's certainly symbolically a significant move, but I think it'll lead to many challenges. I hope that we retain the unity of the Jewish people and
whatever's left, right? Speaking of unity, there'll be unity on display on Sunday up Fifth Avenue.
God willing, there will be unity, that people will remember the importance of sending a message of unity of all Americans behind Israel, and especially a unified Jewish community behind Israel, and that whatever concerns there are right now, the importance of demonstrating where we stand on Israel, that we stand united, is very important. And especially in a political year, that it's one opportunity. I think it's the biggest pro-Israel manifestation of the year.
I want to march with you, Malcolm. Where do I meet you? And I got to be limited on my marching because of my foot problems. Where do I meet you?
I'm not carrying you again. What? It's not happening.
How about one of those things?
My back was out for 3 months. After.
What about the thing where I sit down and you push it along Fifth Avenue? Does that work for you or not?
And you make me yell out, Nachum Segal.
So you're not revealing what block we're going to be meeting at, I see.
It's not up to me. It's up to the next generation. So I'm going to walk with them and see where they will be.
I take this opportunity to wish the Hohenlein and Stein families a Mazel Tov. Ephraim Stein is the bar mitzvah boy. Malcolm will be there tomorrow. This is a shul that you don't normally daven in, right?
Only when I'm visiting my kids.
There you go. So make sure to come on over.
Walking distance.
Make sure to come on over and bother Malcolm at the appropriate times, please. Only at the appropriate times.
Well, they have some very committed and wonderful people. They are young people who do care a lot. And
you're going to be bombarded.
But
please think of me the first time someone says, why can't they just send a super bug into the computer system of Iran and destroy all nuclear capability? Please think of me the first time someone brings that up.
I can promise you I'll be thinking of you when it happens. But, when you see, the important thing is that this bar mitzvah boy carries my late father's name.
Wow.
He had an accident, and this was really, it's a celebration of a miracle, a celebration of bar mitzvah. It's wonderful, healthy young guy who is going to lane this whole parsha and going to speak and do all of that. But
oh, he must be angry. It's the longest parsha.
That's right. He was angry at his parents for a while, not when his mother gave birth. But too often we get caught up in all the events of the day and don't take the longer picture, and that despite all the efforts and the concentration camps, despite who ran them and created them, the attempt to eliminate us and all the other people who call for our destruction, you see that we have next generation, we paid heavy prices for it.
But yeah, Malcolm, how many of our predecessors were never at a grandson's bar mitzvah?
I did not have grandparents, unfortunately.
There you go.
They were all killed in the Holocaust.
Don't have to go back too far to cite examples.
That's right, and it's something I think about very often, because I think grandparents play a special role, but it's the continuity. It's why Hearst says we're judged in the third generation. We're not judged by our children. We're judged by our grandchildren. Because that's when you see come to fruition decisions you make. And I believe it's because of my grandparents and their school. All that they did and the price that they ultimately paid.
Yeah.
It's what enables us to see this continuity.
Who spoils the grandchildren, you or the missus?
Well, I think both of us. Both do a good job.
Then you're both doing a very good job. All right, Malcolm, we'll see you Sunday. Mazel Tov again, and we'll enjoy everybody greeting you at the big parade on Sunday.
Thank you. Be well and have a very good job.
Malcolm Hohenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.